Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the Israeli-Palestinian battle resumes as a ceasefire falls apart. No Iran accord after Kerry talks, but the process continues. Our correspondent finds successful economic development in Erbil, Kurdistan, Iraq.
What has happened between 2005 and 2014 is absolutely astonishing.
And a World Cup official speaks about the biting incident at the games. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Israel and Palestinian militants intensified attacks against each other today after the collapse of a ceasefire deal to end the conflict, which began last week. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports from Gaza, where some Palestinians say they hope for an end to the conflict, but not on Israel's terms.
The leaders of Hamas, the Palestinian political authority in Gaza, have rejected an Egyptian proposal for a ceasefire accepted earlier in the day by Israel. Hamas says it was not included in discussions of the deal, which called for a temporary ceasefire to begin Tuesday, the opening of the borders with Gaza, and talks between Hamas and Israel to take place in Cairo. Officials from the group have also insisted on further conditions, including the lifting of an Israeli blockade on the Palestinian territory. At a news conference, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned of a possible military escalation if Hamas does not accept the deal.
If Hamas rejects the Egyptian proposal and the rocket fire from Gaza does not cease, and that appears to be the case now, we are prepared to continue and intensify our operation to protect our people.
Israeli Defense Forces began a campaign of airstrikes in Gaza last week to counter Palestinian rocket fire aimed at Israel. Israel's military observed a ceasefire for several hours on Tuesday, but resumed airstrikes against Hamas targets, saying the militants were continuing to fire rockets at Israel. Gazan officials say at least 180 Palestinians have been killed so far in the Israeli offensive, the majority of them civilians, while hundreds of homes have been destroyed. The streets of Gaza are virtually deserted, as many people have been staying inside or relocating to UN-run schools to avoid being caught in the crossfire. In Gaza City, fruit vendor Mohammed Saman says he has few customers at his stall in the usually crowded Shati market. He says he supports Hamas's position. I want a ceasefire, but under the conditions of Hamas, not Israel, he says. And I want all the bombarded houses to be rebuilt. Palestinian newspaper columnist and independent analyst Talal Okal says the Israeli military operations have only helped to shore up popular support for Hamas.
For the moment, the popularity of Hamas increased, you know, because the people saw something happen for the first time, you know. The resistance is ready and able to respond, to defend, to do something, you know.
Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, speaking in Vienna Tuesday, condemned Hamas for continuing rocket fire into Israel, despite what he called a goodwill effort to secure a ceasefire. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Gaza.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has ended 3 days of talks in Vienna with his Iranian counterpart without breaking the deadlock over the future of Iran's nuclear program. But lower-level talks will continue at least until a Sunday deadline to reach a long-term agreement. VOA's Al Pessin reports from Vienna.
Secretary Kerry told a news conference there has been progress in the talks with Iran and the other five countries deputized by the UN Security Council. He says an agreement is possible, but it remains out of reach.
We have all continued to negotiate in good faith. But after my conversations here with both Iran and with our P5 plus one partners in particular, it is clear that we still have more work to do.
Kerry declined to provide details of the remaining disputes, but they're believed to center on how much capacity Iran will be allowed for the enrichment of uranium and how long the restrictions will last. Enrichment is an essential step in preparing fuel for nuclear facilities, both for peaceful and military purposes. An agreement would include the reduction and eventual end of international economic sanctions that have crippled Iran's economy. Iran says its nuclear program is and always will be purely peaceful, but Secretary Kerry made clear Iran must take concrete steps to guarantee that.
The first test is to answer the questions and come up with a formula that says to the world This is a peaceful nuclear program, and it cannot be used to make weapons, and we know that to a certainty.
In an interview with the New York Times, Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said Iran is willing to freeze its enrichment program for a few years, but not to reduce it. The international negotiators are believed to be seeking a reduction from current levels for a decade or more. During a break in these talks, Zarif explained how he views the process.
We tried to look into ways and means of bridging the gaps, narrowing the differences that we have, not necessarily by trying to meet halfway, but in fact by trying to look into innovative ways of addressing the problems so that we can reach the objectives of the Geneva Plan of Action.
The effort is complicated by hardline views among some leaders in both Iran and the United States. Iran's supreme leader recently spoke of increasing Iran's enrichment capability by nearly 20 times, but Secretary Kerry did not seem concerned, saying he'd heard the figure before and it represents a long-term plan. Still, many experts believe that while the diplomats and their technical teams probably can work out an agreement, conservative politicians in both the United States and Iran may not accept it. Iran expert Ali Vaez of the International Crisis Group.
These negotiations are more informed by constraints of domestic politics than by real imperatives of national interest.
Still, Vaez says an acceptable agreement can be reached, although probably not by Sunday, and he's not surprised that the talks are going down to the last minute and quite possibly beyond. Secretary Kerry said if there's no accord by Sunday, the United States will assess the progress and the prospects for more and then decide whether to agree on an extension. Al Pessin, VOA News, Vienna.
The U.S. Defense Department confirms it has received the written reports from American teams sent to Iraq to assess the state of the country's military and security situation. But officials caution it still could take some time before any decision is made on what should happen next. VOA's Jeff Seldon has more on the story from the Pentagon.
The assessment from U.S. Special Forces comes about 2 weeks after they first set foot in Baghdad, asked to determine just how far Iraqi security forces had fallen since American troops pulled out in 2011.
The initial work is done. Additional assessment work continues. We have not moved to an advisory capacity at this point.
Pentagon spokesman Rear Admiral John Kirby says U.S. forces have been sharing information with the Iraqis through an operation center in Baghdad and with Kurdish Peshmerga fighters through a center in Erbil. But he says any increase in U.S. assistance will have to wait.
Everybody knows and shares a sense of urgency about what's going on in Iraq. But it's more important to get this issue right than to get it quick.
Iraqi officials have been clamoring for more help, including airstrikes against ISIL targets. But aside from rifles and ammunition, such help has been slow in coming. And information in the classified assessment leaked to the New York Times may make it even more difficult for the U.S. to take a hands-on approach. It warns many Iraqi units have been compromised, infiltrated by Sunni extremists. Jessica Lewis is with the Institute for the Study of War.
One of the considerations actually needs to be how safely can the United States work alongside the Iraqi security forces, given that some of the militias in question are ones that had targeted U.S. soldiers previously.
The Pentagon's plans had called for teams in Iraq to reach out to other potentially friendly forces. But while that's been happening with Kurdish fighters in the north, Pentagon officials say they've not been able to reach out to Shiite militias in and around Baghdad, due in large part to heavy Iranian involvement. Jeff Seldon, VOA News, The Pentagon.
Recent events in Iraq, including the sweep of ISIL in the country and the faltering of Iraq's government in Baghdad, have resulted in the Kurds in Iraq's north to reconsider a centuries-old dream, independence. Kurdish regional president Masoud Barzani recently said that independence is now inevitable. But that formal break from Iraq still does not have a date on the calendar. VOA correspondent Jeffrey Young is in Erbil, Kurdistan, Iraq. He tells us he is impressed by the successful economic development there.
Well, my story starts in 2004 when I first came to Erbil
This was a year after the end of the 2003 war that toppled Saddam Hussein. And when I came here in 2004, Erbil was much smaller. It was humble. There were only older structures. There were only small businesses. It looked pretty much like it did 50, 60 years ago, except for maybe just a building here and a building there. In 2005, I came back, and it was almost the same way. There was a little bit of development. What has happened between 2005 and 2014 is absolutely astonishing. Because the Kurdistan region is stable, politically stable, militarily stable, outside investors, people from all over the world, looked at Kurdistan and said, yes, this is a place of opportunity. This is a place where we can put our money and we can build businesses and make fantastic profits. And because of the stability of the government and its respect for investment, that we can put the money and have the feeling of security that our investments will be respected and protected. And because of this, it has been a flood of money coming in from all over the world. There is construction here financed by all the way in Asia, in places like South Korea. There's European money here. It's from all over the world. And what has happened in just a short amount of time, in just a less than 10 years, this is becoming a little Dubai. It is fabulous. Everywhere you look, there are big steel and glass towers. There are gorgeous luxury hotels. The one I'm staying in right now is beyond belief. The room that I have, the facilities that I have, it's fantastic. In 10 years ago, if you would have said all of this was going to happen, people would have said, you're silly. This is a dream. But as I said, the big difference, what has happened is there is stability here. There is respect for law. There is respect for investment. And that's what the big change is. No one wants to put money in a place with serious risk. That's why if money comes to Iraq, it is not going to Baghdad. It is coming to Erbil. Baghdad is a completely different world. If you put something in Baghdad, maybe you have it, maybe you lose it. That's not the way it is here in Kurdistan. Sitting with me at the Jaguar Land Rover dealer, and this looks like something from Washington, D.C. It's a gleaming, beautiful building. It's unbelievable. And it's full of Jaguars that cost an incredible amount of money. And they're all over the streets, not one or two. I see dozens of them every single day. With me is Firas Babir, the National Marketing Director for Jaguar and Land Rover here in Erbil. And I'll let him tell a little bit of the story. Firas, how do you see this? What opportunities do you see in Kurdistan? How do you think the economic development is going?
I've recently just come into Erbil 6 months ago, but I've actually seen the potential in this region. I've seen the investment in naked eye coming in, as you kindly said, from the eastern countries, from the Middle East, from the Gulf region, even from the Americans, and from the Turks as well. I could see here there's a lot of potential. It's a cash country. There's huge potential. You can see the investment. We are growing massively. We're opening up different districts in Kurdistan, and we're just waiting until the opportunities that are coming along.
Thank you, Firas. And there's another aspect to this story as well. Right now, all of Iraq is using the official government Iraqi currency, the currency of Baghdad, that is backed by the Central Bank of Iraq. And the NID, the new Iraqi dinar, is not a strong currency because over all of Iraq, the economy is not that strong. Look at what is happening right now with ISIL taking a big chunk of the country. People do not want to put money in places that are going to be overrun by insurgents or their business is going to be taken away, or even worse, everybody gets killed. The big difference here, Kurdistan is stable. And again, as I said before, it respects investment. And if Kurdistan becomes an independent state that issues its own currency, its currency will be immensely strong, like the euro or some other major currency in the West, because it is backed by the oil in the ground, it's backed by the strong economy, and it's backed by opportunity.
Jeff, are people there confident that ISIL will not invade this region?
I know from my firsthand experience from being with the Peshmerga before in 2004 and 2005, this is the strongest military force in this entire region. ISIL has not tried to come anywhere near Erbil. It has not tried to go into Kurdistan at all. They know better. They know that if they come here, they get killed. The Peshmerga will not let anyone defeat them. I have seen this with my own eyes.
VOA correspondent Jeffrey Young speaking with us from Erbil, Kurdistan, Iraq. Violence and abuse against women and girls in developing countries has long been a common practice, and in regions of conflict, mistreatment of them is used as a means of warfare. Women's rights advocate Michelle Rickett is founder and CEO of She Is Safe, an organization that rescues and rehabilitates women and girls who are victims of abuse. The organization has been at the forefront of bringing awareness to gendercide, child marriage, and the abduction and slavery of girls. Rickett is also the author of the recently released book, Forgotten Girls, a book that she says serves as a call to action to break the cycle of exploitation and violence against young women. She spoke with us earlier about the effects of abuse on young women and girls. Today, she speaks with VOA's Kim Lewis about some of the programs provided by her organization that help victims rise above their circumstances and become contributors to society.
What She Is Safe focuses on is a full spectrum of prevention, rescue, and restoration. The restoration side, generally this involves making sure that women or girls are in a safe location, whether it's a safe house or a village that's been negotiated with the leader so that they will receive women and girls there, or if we can work with their own communities, which is by far the very best way women and girls can stay where they've grown up. And there we introduce what we call transformation groups. So we gather the women together on a weekly basis, and they are facilitated through a process of learning literacy skills, learning about health and hygiene and abuse prevention and recourse steps, as well as working together to create a common loan fund so that the women are gaining financial literacy skills. And during that process, they are learning, each of them is learning to be a leader and understanding the power of working together.
And so how are the women and girls rescued from these abusive situations to get to the safe havens?
Well, that is the job that She Is Safe has dedicated ourselves to. So we look for the areas where women and girls are known to be abused, exploited, trafficked. And the information is available, so we set up a long-term focus in a given community or area. I'll give you a for instance. There is a district of Nepal where it is known that most girls after the age of 12 will be sold into the brothels of India. And most people who work in Nepal and they're addressing the abuse and exploitation of women and girls know about this infamous district. So we've set our sights on the district, and we began to create relationships in the communities there, working with the women, as I've described. And then in this relationship with the women, we're facilitating this discussion about our girls at risk of certain things and what could be done about it. So we really help them become the problem solvers.
So then what is the key factor, would you say, in women in these situations becoming empowered? Is it that they're getting the information door-to-door in their communities, or they're uniting, or what is the key thing that is giving them this empowerment?
I think it has to start with a process so that the women begin to explore in their own minds and hearts, what are the losses that we are all experiencing because of the way that women and girls are mistreated. Once we get that conversation going, it's amazing how the group is galvanized.
Also, just wanted to touch briefly on your measurement of success. How do you measure the success of your programs?
Well, we set benchmarks every single year in each of our programs. What we're looking for, of course, are not only numbers of people in our program, say in that transformation group year-long program. In India alone, we have about 5,000 women right now. What we want to see in their lives is that they are making good decisions about helping each other, so that lending program is going well, so everyone in the group has their opportunity to lead and to understand how this all works. A girl who is kept in school is far less likely to ever be abused or sold or to sell or abuse her own daughters. So that's a game changer for us. We want to see these women using those funds to keep their daughters in school. And one of the first things we started tracking, we did not anticipate, women would say, well, my husband doesn't beat me as much anymore. That's a step in the right direction.
Michelle Rickett, founder of She Is Safe. On the day after the end of the World Cup in Brazil, FIFA chief Sepp Blatter and the World Cup Local Organizing Committee met with reporters in Rio de Janeiro Monday. Blatter talked about a number of topics from the recent games, including the ban of footballer Luis Suarez, who was sent home early from the World Cup after biting another player in Uruguay's group win over Italy. It was the third time Suarez had bitten a fellow professional, and FIFA's disciplinary committee banned the Barcelona forward from all football-related activity for 4 months. Here is Sepp Blatter.
Concerning the matter of Suarez, as a footballer, I feel with him. I feel that such a punishment, it hurts. It hurts. But as the president of FIFA, I have to accept what decisions they are taken by our independent committees, and I do hope that this player will come back to football because on the pitch, what he has shown so far before his elimination, he has not played the first match with his team, with Uruguay, but later on you have seen the capacity, technical, tactical, and his smelling to go towards goals. I do hope he will be back. He's now in one of the greatest clubs in the world, and I'm sure he will have a good place there. And his position, he will confirm his position.
Blatter also gave Brazil a higher grade than South Africa, which hosted the 2010 World Cup based on certain social media statistics. Blatter said Brazil was only a quarter higher. FIFA Secretary General Jerome Valak commented on the Rio de Janeiro police operation to investigate the alleged scalping of World Cup hospitality tickets.
I want to say that I'm sure that there will be other stories, but what you cannot say is that FIFA is not fighting permanently against this business. We are against this business at 1,000%, and we'll be always fighting. And again, there were cases in South Africa. There were people arrested, and there were people arrested here. I mean, it went to the press even before it came to us, the story in Rio, but that's another question. But again, we never say that to any authorities that we will not support their action and investigation, and we always bring them and give them all of our support, because again, as the CEO of FIFA, or Secretary General of FIFA, I can say there was not a single ticket which came out of FIFA ticketing at a price which was above the face value of the tickets.
Germany won this year's World Cup Sunday in a match that went into extra time. The final score was Germany 1, Argentina 0. The win was Germany's first as a united country. West Germany won the World Cup in 1954, 1974, and 1990. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.